You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Welcome to Cool Stuff Ride Home, Marcus Papp alongside Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, we leave Earth's atmosphere to ask the question, after nearly 50 years, have we heard the last from Voyager 1? The latest from the U.S. government on the existence of UFOs. Is the truth really out there? Plus, this day in history takes a look at the normal school. We'll tell you more. That's coming up on Cool Stuff.
Voyager 1 has been in space and sending information to NASA for nearly 50 years now. But could that be coming to an end? In the summer of 1977, Voyager 1 was launched into space from Cape Canaveral, Florida, and it is now over 15 billion miles away, which some consider beyond the edge of our solar system. Its original mission was only supposed to last 4 years as it surveyed Jupiter and Saturn. Now, NASA is worried about the spacecraft. The messages being sent back to Earth haven't been making sense for nearly 6 months now. Since mid-November, Voyager 1 has had issues with its ability to speak. Suzanne Dodd from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, has been the project manager for Voyager since 2010 and said, quote, "It basically stopped talking to us in a coherent manner. It's a serious problem," end quote. In order to talk with NASA, the spacecraft would send messages in binary code. However, now it is just sending back alternating ones and zeros. It sounds like they tried the classic, you know, turning it off and turning it back on method, or at least that's what I always do, or at least they did something like that. Dodd said they have tried the usual methods for resetting it, but they haven't had any luck. There appears to be a problem with the onboard computer, which Dodd described as primitive. In fact, she said that key fob for your car has more computing power than the Voyager 1 has. Quote, "The button you press to open the door for your car, that has more compute power than Voyager 1 spacecrafts do. It's remarkable that they keep flying and that they've flown for 46 plus years," end quote. They haven't given up hope yet. They are looking at some of the old original documents to try and fix the problem. In fact, they commented on how they're looking at the yellow sheets of paper because they're so old and faded. quote, "They're doing a lot of work to try and get into the heads of the original developers and figure out why they designed something the way they did and what we could possibly try that might give us some answers to what's going wrong with the spacecraft," end quote. If they can't get Voyager 1 to speak coherently, they will start trying to get more bold and risky on what commands they send to try to fix the problem. It could take weeks or months to see if anything works, especially since it takes a full day for the commands to reach the spacecraft and another day for anything to get sent back.
Can you imagine how frustrating that would be, Reggie, as a technician on all this? You're going, well, let's try this. And then we're all accustomed to the internet age of, hey, a nanosecond later, we've got our answer. But nope. You got to wait 48 hours to find out if this very basic command you sent out there to try to fix the problem is going to have any effect.
Yeah. When you hit send, it's not you're just going out for lunch to see what comes back. You're going, I'm going home for the day. I'll see what comes back tomorrow.
It's like snail mail compared to email here. You're going, yeah, you should have that letter in a few days. Let us know how it goes.
The researchers that sift through the data that Voyager 1 sends back have been very disappointed that they haven't been able to get any information since this issue started. They are curious what the environment looks like that Voyager 1 is currently traveling through because space isn't empty. There could be gases, dust, cosmic rays. While the spacecraft's twin Voyager 2 is still running and out further than ever expected as well, it can't take the same measurements that Voyager 1 can, so they are missing out on some data. Now, even if they do get it running, there's still a limit on how long it'll last. Both probes are powered by plutonium. The team has taken steps to preserve both, like turning off heaters, but with the power it has, they expect the final instrument will run out of power by 2030. However, even then, its mission technically won't be over. as it carries that golden record and has greetings recorded in several languages along with sounds from Earth. But if you look at that, I'm going pessimistic here. Even if it's lucky enough to find intelligent life, it'll be about 40,000 years before it gets close to another star. At about 1.7 light years away, it'll reach one of these stars in the Ursa Minor constellation. NASA has been working on a new mission that could send a probe that would go twice as far as Voyager 1 in 50 years. They need the funding approved, but if it is, that could launch in the 2030s.
Man, this whole thing is fascinating in a lot of ways. You know, you mentioned the scientific computing power of this being less than a key fob. I know technology wasn't as good in the 1950s, obviously, or 60s, but a key fob? I guess 1977 was when this actually launched. The 70s.
They probably started building it in the late 60s, early 70s is probably when they first started working on this.
That is just fascinating that that's the extent of its computational power.
Well, think about it. There used to be rooms that took up the computing power of your laptop now.
Yeah, you're right. I guess it's just in my mind, I'm trying to reconcile that with the fact that they had the technology to blast something into space that lasted for 46 years and is now on the outer edges, if not beyond our solar system. I mean, that's a pretty huge accomplishment in its own right. And yet it can just send back some ones and zeros. Crazy.
Yeah. And think that you could hook up your phone to something like that and imagine the amount of computing power it would have if they could just had one cell phone to hook up to that thing.
Can we blast a rocket off and get an iPhone attached to that thing really fast? No, we can't. That's how far away it is. I mean, that's pretty mind boggling in its own right. Well, it does go to show you that if we sent something up there today, by the time it got to where Voyager 1 is at this stage in its life, how outdated would that technology be? You know, we joke about attaching a smartphone, but that'll probably be on the low end of the technology spectrum at that point.
Yeah, and it sounds like if they get approval for that new spacecraft probe or whatever you want to call it going out there, it might pass Voyager 1 in like the next 50, 60 years. You know, it'll zoom by it because they'll be able to get it going faster. So at some point, maybe Voyager 1, you'll still be traveling out there, but the other one will go past it. Maybe this time we can put a CD or MP3 or something in there instead of a record.
These aliens are really going to think we're behind the times.
Yeah. Honey, get the turntable. We got something from space.
Do we still have one of those down in the basement? Well, staying in space, sort of, UFO enthusiasts likely won't be thrilled with this next story. Per Sky News, many UFO sightings, including those at Roswell, New Mexico, were likely from people who unknowingly saw testing or the use of classified government technology. That, according to the Pentagon in their newly released, quote, "The report on the historical record of U.S. government involvement with unidentified anomalous phenomena."
I mean, what do you expect them to say? Isn't that been what they've been saying since the beginning of this whole phenomena? Oh, it was just testing. I mean, come on.
Sort of. And we'll touch on that a little bit because, no, last year, that wasn't all that was coming out of Washington. Of course, for some background, the Pentagon created the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, or AARO, back in 2022, just as this topic really seemed to be heating up again, to investigate reports of unknown objects. It was that same office that released this latest report after reviewing government investigations from as far back as 1945. Ultimately, they found there was no evidence of the U.S. having alien bodies or technology. Though I'm guessing, like Reggie, this isn't going to be nearly enough to put the lid back on this topic and keep the skeptics at bay. Now, as previously noted, the AARO said many UFO sightings from over the years could be attributed to people who unknowingly saw the testing or use of classified technology. Speaking of Roswell specifically, since that seems to be the most popular sighting from over the years, residents of the small New Mexico town claimed to see an alien spacecraft crashing back in 1947, but the AARO says that's all consistent with Project Mogul, a classified program that used microphones flown on high-altitude balloons in a bid to detect Soviet nuclear bomb tests. Per the AARO, quote, all investigative efforts at all levels of classification concluded that most sightings were ordinary objects and phenomena and the result of misidentification, end quote.
I'm a little curious, how are microphones helping you find nuclear bombs? I'm sure there's some technology about it, but I'm a little confused on that.
Yeah, I don't know the ins and outs of that, but I don't think that's the most implausible part of the story, put it that way. If there's some sort of a sound wave that might be associated with a nuclear blast, and I'm speaking off the cuff here, I'm no scientist, of course, but fair enough of a question from you, Reggie. Now, I was going to say, you might be asking yourself why the term most in that last statement. Well, that's because many reports, despite the AARO's efforts, remain unsolved. But the government agency claims that with more data, most of them could be identified and resolved as ordinary objects or phenomena. In my opinion, again, none of this is likely to make this topic go away, especially after three military veterans testified before Congress just last July, with one of them, a former Air Force intelligence officer, claiming the U.S. government has operated a secret multi-decade reverse engineering program of recovered vessels. He also said the U.S. has recovered non-human biologics from alleged crash sites. At that time, retired Major David Grush, who'd gone from being part of the Pentagon's task force that released this most recent report, to becoming a whistleblower, told Congress he'd been denied access to some government UFO programs, but that he knows the exact locations of UAPs, that is the government's term or acronym for UFOs, in U.S. possession. That all coming to us from an NPR report. Here's another interesting tidbit. Moving forward, the AARO revealed plans for portable UFO detection kits to collect more data on sightings. Acting Director Timothy Phillips said the new kits, currently being tested in Texas, would have an array of sensors that fit inside a protective case. He told CNN, quote, if we have a national security site and there are objects being reported that are within restricted airspace or within a maritime range or within the proximity of one of our spaceships, we need to understand what that is. And so that's why we're developing sensor capability that we can deploy in reaction to reports, end quote. The system is called Gremlin and could be deployed to a site with multiple reports, again, of UAP or UFOs. So, Reggie, as you sort of already alluded to, I don't think this is going to stop the conversation anytime soon.
No, and in my opinion, what a horrible name, AARO. Couldn't they come up with something better? I don't know.
I'm tired. I mean, I'm already worn out from all the acronyms that we had here. Even just referencing CNN in here got to be like, man, NPR. Okay, I get it. You're on board. UFOs, UAPs, AARO. My goodness.
I was just going to say that. You even threw in the news organizations in there. You got them all down. Welcome to CSRH.
Hopefully you're all keeping up with these acronyms because it can be hard to follow.
I do agree that I feel like most times you see things in the sky, they're easily explained. Now, am I a little bit of a conspiracy theorist or a little bit hopeful after seeing all these movies? Like, hey, maybe there's something out there? A little bit, I guess. I don't know. There might be something. I'm willing to admit I don't know everything out there, and UFOs could be one of those, but I do agree that I feel like most of the things are government testing that they don't want to tell us about. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think I'm on the same page as you. I'm open-minded to these things, and I'm not of the opinion that with the vast expanses of space out there, that it's impossible for life somewhere else to exist. I guess my question would be, why do they come down here and try to zip around in anonymity, save for a few instances in which they actually present themselves to people, but nobody ever has photos. The government always seems to get there first, even though we live in a smartphone age. I mean, there's a lot of questions that don't really seem to jive with this, but I'm not turning my mind off completely to the fact that they may exist in certain instances. But like you said, I think most of these probably can be easily explained, but there are some others that you have to raise an eyebrow and at least ask the question. So As we always say with these stories, we'll see where it goes from here, but I can't imagine this is going to do anything but stoke the flames a bit and have those UFO enthusiasts talking even more.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Taking a look at this day in history, on March 10th, 1823, the first normal school in the U.S. opened in Concord, Vermont. The Concord Academy was founded by Reverend Samuel Reed Hall. He believed that teachers needed to be taught how to teach in a standard manner. So when I say normal school, that doesn't mean like your typical school. It's a school to teach teachers.
Non-weird teachers.
Yes. Normal schools actually started in France in the 1600s. They called them, and I'm just taking a guess here, École Normale, which means normal school in French.
Very good. Steve, you're like a French native speaker there,
thank
Reg.
You. Yeah, it's just flows naturally. Steve Perkins from the Vermont Historical Society said that if we think of the English term for norms as in standards, we can then say it's a standard school where we are teaching teachers standards. I feel like that could be a tongue twister if you say it enough times. Teaching teachers. He said, quote, "We still do that today. Teachers are certified and we have curriculum where they know that they have to have certain standards that they have to teach to," end quote. So at the normal school, there would be both students and teachers learning. The students would learn the typical way, while teachers would learn the proper way to teach for those students, you know, in that standard way. According to Perkins, quote, "Samuel Reed Hall felt the best way to get at education was through geography. So if you teach a child about the community that they live in, you can start with the landscape. You can build out to history, culture. It's still a very valid way of teaching and the way that we teach our kids today," end quote. Of course, now teachers are expected to go to college, take courses to stay updated on the best practices to teach. Perkins did add, though, that in Vermont, Johnson and Linden State Colleges both began as normal schools, but they have now transitioned into teacher training colleges now. You know, the more common way that teachers learn now. They don't really have normal schools anymore. It's, you know, you go to college, and like I said, you continue your education as you continue your career.
Interesting, because I've heard that term normal school for years and years, and I never had any idea what it meant. So thank you, Reggie, because now I do. I have some background here. It's more of a standard school. Interesting that Samuel Reed Hall felt education best starts with geography. That's not what I would have picked had I been forced to guess, but he has his rationale. And as far as the overall concept, I think it's always good to have standards and norms in terms of how a school would operate. But at the same time, I would want to encourage my teachers to have multiple ways of thinking about and presenting certain topics, because I think we've all come to accept for the most part that not every student learns the same way. You have to be able to think about these and explain concepts in different manners to try to reach everyone in your classroom. Probably not always going to successfully do that, but to reach the maximum number of people, you may need to present it in slightly different ways, even if there are standards in place, which again, I think is a good thing ultimately.
All right, before we close out Cool Stuff Ride Home, I would—
Are you going to solicit complaints again?
No. I do have a follow-up though. You remember on Friday, we talked about the doppelganger.
Yes.
And I talked about my generic looks. Well, it happened again. I was at the grocery store and 3 guys walk by. I'm like, "Hey, he looks like Craig." And I look up and they're all looking at me. So I'm assuming they're talking about me. And then it reminded me of a story when this was probably 15 years ago. I was at the grocery store. I kept walking down the aisles and a little kid kept saying "daddy" every time I walked by them, which was kind of concerning to me. I happened to get behind this person at the checkout lane and the kid said "daddy" again. She goes, "I'm so sorry, but you do look exactly like her dad." So again, generic.
Generic white guy Reggie.
That's right.
Co-host of Cool Stuff Ride Home. You should have asked, "Hey, does your husband have a podcast?"
Usually I have a better comeback and I should have told her that she's a lucky lady if her dad looks like me. But I just wanted to give that follow-up on how generic looking I really am.
Rim shot.
So that will do it for another Cool Stuff Ride Home. If you do have those complaints or suggestions, corrections, coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Like us, follow us, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well, if you could. I'm Reggie Rizzo. He's Marcus Path. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.